ebook publishers and marketing services company, Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join a Downpour audiobook club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $14.99 per month. That's Downpour.com. On this episode, we hear from Danish singer-songwriter Clay Sim. Sergio Magana lands in Rogue Valley for his Obsidian Mirror workshop, and we feature the new audiobook from internationally acclaimed writer Sue Grafton, right after the news you want to know.
I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Chrissy McIntyre.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
And I'm Maya Seligman. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. Ellen DeGeneres is going fishing again with a sequel to the animated blockbuster Finding Nemo. Disney and its Pixar animation unit recently announced that Ellen will reprise her Nemo voice role for Finding Dory. The sequel is due out November 2015 and will be directed by Andrew Stanton, who also made Finding Nemo.
Love that guy.
Is he related to you?
He is.
What's the relation?
He's my cousin.
That's right. Wow, cool. Stanton. Well, it took in $921 million worldwide and was the first Pixar production to win the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature after the category was added in 2001. And Ellen says, I've waited for this day for a long, 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 long time. She said that.
Yeah, it took a long time to say that.
Yes, it did. I'm not mad it took this long, she said. I know that the people at Pixar were busy creating Toy Story 16, but the time they took was worth it. The new film picks up about a year after the action of Finding Nemo with Ellen's fish Dory on her own adventure to reunite with loved ones. She praises the script, saying, it has everything I loved about the first one. It's got a lot of heart, it's really funny, and the best part is, it's got a lot more Dory.
Who here hasn't seen Finding Nemo?
Uh-oh, me.
Oh, really?
Oh, that's too bad. It's adorable.
It's adorable.
Oh. That has to be a linguistic fallacy.
No, just a bad pun.
Okay.
Well, it's one of my mom's favorites, so I'm definitely going to check it out.
It's quite a popular film, you know. Andrew won the Academy Award for Best Director for that movie. Mm-hmm. And on a side note, with Ellen DeGeneres was at the Kennedy Center Honors. She won the award, and she was talking, and she mentioned Andrew Stanton. One, how much she liked working with him, but two, how much he revived her career. Because at the time, when he gave her the part of Dory in Finding Nemo, of course, nobody knew it was going to blow up to be, you know, the billion-dollar picture. No one in Hollywood would work with her because she had just got her TV series canceled for coming out of the closet. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, back in the 90s, and people weren't, you know, as open-minded then as they were as they are now.
So that was her...
That was her vehicle to get back on top. And then she got her talk show, and the rest is history.
Yeah, now she's really on top. My God.
Yeah, she's all over the place.
Huge.
She's bigger than Dory.
Yeah, she got lots of friends, like Taylor Swift. I was thinking you could maybe set me up on a date with her.
With Taylor Swift?
Yeah.
She would dump you and then write a song about it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. That'd be kind of fun, though. I'd be honored.
I would be honored to be dumped by Taylor Swift.
Yeah. I could take her to the movies. We could go see... Finding Nemo 2.
There you go. She would like that.
And then they can make a YouTube video out of it, which could become a thing of the past, though. Sarah Silverman and her crew hosted a barbecue brunch at South by Southwest to announce a joint venture with Google, YouTube, and a host of other comedians called the Jash Comedy Network. It is one of 60 YouTube networks announced that will provide financing for comedians and artists. The networks will also have production resources available to them, as well as editing facilities and creative control. Artists will share in revenues for each video. In the epic intro, Silverman and the gang are joined by an alleged Google executive who announces there are too many videos on the web. Jash will replace all internet videos, including Charlie Bit My Finger and other viral favorites.
Charlie Bit My Finger. I love that one. Now, you know, since everybody hasn't seen Finding Nemo, which, by the way, you need to go. But I'm assuming everybody's seen Charlie Bit My Finger.
Yeah,
I have not seen that.
Chrissy!
I know. What's wrong with me?
It's very short. It's two little kids. They're British. It's hysterical.
Okay.
So Charlie Bit My Finger video is going to be gone. Well, not really. I mean, they can't get rid of all these YouTube classics and favorites that we love to watch. But I guess, you know, Sarah Silverman and her crew, they're going to have a bunch of videos on. And, you know, people who like their humor are going to really enjoy it. I don't know. What do you guys think of Sarah Silverman's comedy act?
I love her. I love how she pushes the edges and says things that shock your socks off. But she's just so blunt. It cracks me up.
And she does it with such a great smile on her face. I mean, she could just say the most horrible thing in the world, but she's just smiling while she does it, so you don't mind.
She's so cute. This is sort of like that Funny or Die kind of thing, where they make web series. Is that what you're saying? And
yeah, what they're going to do is... Well, what they are doing is YouTube is tapping into a global audience. That's the thing. If I have a TV show, if we have a Get Behind Me Now, Stay There show, which we would love to do, it not only would it be available to everyone in America, but it would be available to everyone around the world.
Well, YouTube has its place, but television is still trying to make its mark, and there's some new channels coming on the board every day. A new one is Nick Mom, which is part of Nickelodeon, and they've just given a series order, a scripted comedy called Instant Mom, and it's going to star... Tia Mowdry Hardrick. You remember her from Sister Sister. The Hollywood Reporter has learned that they've ordered this half-hour series, and it's the first original scripted effort to join the block on this channel. And it's going to repeat also on Nick at Night. Instant Mom follows a young party girl named Stephanie who trades in Cosmos for carpools because she marries an older guy named Charlie, played by Michael Boatman, and he has three kids. So it's about a girl who has to transition from her like crazy party life. All of a sudden now she has three kids to deal with and she's a stepmom. So it's an interesting story because
it almost sounds like a reality show.
Yeah, it does, but it's a scripted comedy. I have a friend who did just that and actually should probably write for them because she probably knows a little something about this.
Does she have some good stories?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, you're a stepmother. First of all, you've never been a mother before. And then now you have three kids that, you know, stepmoms don't always get a good rap.
No, they don't.
It'd be hard to jump in like that.
You know, hey, Snow White comes to mind.
I was going to say, all those fairy tales weren't filled with evil mothers. They were evil stepmothers.
Yes, they were. Well, Bronwyn O'Keefe, who's a senior VP of Nick Mom, said, Instant Mom is the perfect addition to our Nick Mom nighttime comedy block, designed to let moms unwind from the day and laugh at the often hilarious experiences of parenthood, which I should imagine there are a few. So I'm wondering if... the Instant Mom is ever going to get slimed, you know.
Where's Mark Summers when you need him?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Good thing they don't do that to musicians and actors and things like that.
Well, another musician who is famous on that show is the lady who sang Ironic.
Alanis Morissette?
Yeah, she was on You Can't Do That on Television.
That's right, she was.
That's right.
And speaking of musicians, Journey is definitely a band that has been around. Don't Stop Believin', Every Man's Journey is the name of a new documentary detailing Arnel Pineda's Too Amazing to Be Real musical fairy tale. It's the story of a virtually unknown singer stepping into the role of frontman for one of rock's most legendary bands, Journey. Does it sound a bit insane, you guys?
It sounds really insane. And I've read this story, Maya, and you know, the way that he got discovered is even more insane.
Yeah. Well, as the song goes, don't stop believing. After growing up in a struggling Filipino household and spending several years on the streets of Manila, Pineda managed to gain local acclaim after joining a neighborhood band, although he never gained much attention outside of the Philippines. But that all changed in 2007 when Pineda, who had a series of videos on YouTube covering favorite American rock songs, including Journey's classic Faithfully, he received an eye-opening email. It read, "Interested in singing for the real band Journey?" And it was signed Neil Sean. Yes.
Yeah,
so he's Journey's founding member and guitarist.
Right. Yeah.
So at first, of course, he was skeptical. I mean, wouldn't you be? He thought it was a scam.
Yeah, I'd be like, yeah, right, whatever.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, delete.
Yeah, like I believe it.
It's like, would you be interested in coming to the White House? Barack.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. It's about as believable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he ended up replying to the email, and he discovered that, indeed, it was a legit kind of letter. And Sean was asking him to be part of the group because he had gone through a number of steps to try to find someone. And finally, the last resort was that he saw that YouTube video, and so he emailed him.
Have you guys heard this guy sing?
Yeah, he sounds just like Steve Perry.
I was going to say, yeah, crazy. I mean, if I was Neil Sean and I'm looking for a replacement for Steve Perry, and this, I watched this guy, you could turn your head and you would think it was Steve Perry.
Yeah.
This is not like having to choose between like Sammy Lee Hagar and
David Lee Roth.
No, this is like, it's the same guy, he's just in a smaller package.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, a short Asian dude exactly. with a very talented voice.
A little bit younger, too.
I think
right?
he's a communist, too.
Oh boy. Well, if you're interested in learning more, there's now this documentary about the amazing tale. And Pineda said, "I'm living my dreams. We're selling hope. Dreams, they do come true. Miracles can overcome misery and hardship." What a good story.
Definitely. You know, there really is a great story because, you know, this guy, you know, he does sound a lot like Steve Perry, who has a beautiful voice. You know, here he is, you know, he's a street kid. You know, in the Philippines, and, you know, he makes a few videos, and he wants to be a rock star. You never would think that was going to come to fruition, and then, bam, you know, one of the biggest bands in the world says, yeah, you know, you're the guy.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, you're singing, you know, to sold out audiences all around the world.
Yeah.
He didn't even want to post the video. His friend, like, kind of forced him to put it up there.
But he was a little grateful afterwards.
Yeah, I should think. Yeah.
He was very scared going out on his first concert in front of 20,000 people. He got really nervous, understandably, you know.
He's just right. Well, like on American Idol or something, they kind of build him up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they start off with the audition in front of like a couple famous people, and it gets progressively larger and larger audience.
Right. That's a smart way of doing it.
Yeah, this guy just got thrown right in the frying pan.
Yeah, here he goes from singing in front of a couple of friends to 20,000 of his closest friends in Chile.
Right.
It's an easy transition.
And, you know, and it would have to be, you know, like a not only nerve-wracking for him to perform in front of that many people, but think about it. Everyone around him is so used to doing this.
It's old hat.
Right.
It's old hat. They're like, yeah, don't worry about it, kid. You know, and he's the only one that's ever walked out in front of, you know, 20, 30,000 screaming fans and doesn't know what his experience is like. Because normally, like in a band like Journey, say when they were coming up, they did the same thing that Cy was implying about the American Idol. They played bars and they played bigger venues till they got big. So that by the time they got big, they were used to it.
Yeah,
but also the expectation that this guy is going to sound like Steve Perry. I mean, you know, if he messes up a note or does something different, you know, he's going to hear about it.
Well, you know what? He does not disappoint. And let's hear a little bit of it right now.
Yes, a small town girl living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere. Took the midnight train, go anywhere.
Wow, it is true. I mean, dreams really do come true. And it was making me think about, Cyrus, you were telling me about that, the new teen millionaire sold some big thing to Yahoo, I think it was.
Yeah, the 17-year-old app inventor. You know, if you got a tech idea and you want to make a fortune before you're out of your teens, just do it.
I just missed it. I had the idea last year. I should have submitted it.
Yeah, I should have wrote it down. It was a real good one. I had.
I didn't know how to write cursive yet.
Yeah.
Last year?
Yeah.
That's Nick's advice. He's a London schoolboy who just sold his smartphone news app to Yahoo for a reported $30
million. Oh, my God.
That's a good little chunk of change. He was inspired by the frustrating experience of scrolling through Google searches and separate websites to find information. The app is powered by an algorithm that automatically boils down articles to about 400 characters. This is amazing. Like math condensing
literature.
Yeah, literature is story. Wow.
It's like a Reader Digest for apps, or is that what it is?
Essentially, yeah, yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, it's such a, you know, just an amazing idea that it caught the eye of Horizons Ventures, a venture capital firm owned by a Hong Kong billionaire that invested $250,000. That investment attracted other celebrity backers, among them Hollywood actor Ashton Kutcher, British broadcaster Stephen Fry, artist Yoko Ono, and News Corp media mogul Murdoch. That all added up to maximum publicity when the Sumly app launched in November 2012, with the backers bringing in more than just cash for the app that has been downloaded close to a million times.
Wow. Have you had a chance to download it? Or
Not yet, but I'm definitely going
to
do it.
I'm curious to check it out now.
Yeah, it's
brilliant. He's only 17.
I know, he's only 17.
I actually heard an interview with him, and he's studying for his college exams. He's already created a multi-million dollar app company, but he's still going to go to college. Like, he's still going to go and, you know, he's still got to get his
degree.
Like,
he still has to figure out what he wants to do with his life.
Yeah, he's got to figure out.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, he designed the car, but he has to wait to get his driver's license. Right.
Well, at least now he can pay his tuition at MIT, right?
Right. You know, there's another fascinating thing about him is that he taught himself to code at age 12 when Apple launched their app store.
An interesting thing about that, the Apple App Store, I saw an article not too long ago about this almost like a new gold rush for writing apps. People quitting their jobs, buying, you know, several Mac computers and trying to come up essentially with the next big thing. And then you read this and it's, you know, 17-year-old kid who comes up with the next big thing. So inspiration could strike anywhere, anytime.
You know what? Yeah. And it's, you know, the internet has just opened up like a whole new, you know, world for everyone. And it just seems like, you know, everyone, you know, can fulfill dreams and things can just happen. And, you know, speaking of, you know, the internet, Maya, you were telling me about this Veronica Mars thing. And I was like, wow, you know, you talk about the power of the internet.
No kidding. Well, the Veronica Mars movie can happen thanks to Kickstarter on the internet. It used to be a TV series, and thanks to the crowdfunding site Kickstarter, which was originally founded in 2009, it has raised over $5 million in just a month. It surpassed its original goal of $2 million by April 12th, and it ranks as the most funded project in Kickstarter's film category, with the highest goal of any successfully funded project. According to Kickstarter, it was also the fastest project to reach $1 million. Guess how long, you guys, it took?
I don't know.
It blew me away. 4 hours and 24 minutes the same day.
Man, wow. We're in the wrong business.
That is a rabid fan base.
Yes. Jeez. It was right after the series creator Rob Thomas and the star Kristen Bell launched the drive, it just shot up into success.
You know, and it's funny because I heard Kristen Bell talk about it, right? Because the Veronica Mars, the TV series, I've never seen the TV show. Mm-hmm. And apparently not a lot of people did either, because that's why it got canceled. But they had like a cult following, right? And so they had approached, you know, Kristen Bell about doing the movie many times, and there just wasn't money for it. And she's gone on to, you know, be in Forgetting Sarah Marshall and House of Lies and all this other big time stuff. And she said, if you put it on the side, if you raise the money, she would associate her name with it. She said, only if it raised $2 million in a week.
Oh.
Because sure. And she's just like, you know, if there really is a hardcore fan base out there, it'll happen.
Wow.
That's really awesome. I mean, it's a chance for them to put their money where their mouth is. I mean, you could say you like a TV show, but are you willing to put the money up to make a movie happen?
Well, a little over 32,000 backers, they supported this one. And they made pledges in exchange for a variety of awards, which ranged from a PDF of the shooting script for a $10 pledge to a one-line speaking part in the film for a $10,000 pledge.
Oh, wow.
It only cost you $10,000.
That's fine. Yeah. I mean, real, you know, all the acting classes probably spend that much anyway.
Well, if you do the math, I mean, it sounds like all 32,000 people are going to be in a movie. Because that's a lot of money.
That's
a good one. So I didn't even put those two together. So I was supposed to be using the new Yahoo app over there.
That's a big cast. They don't have enough trailers for everyone.
Yeah.
Well, there's probably a couple of really big donors and then, you know, everybody else. Yeah. It's amazing the power of the internet to, you know, to rally the people behind something like this. Like, I was a big fan of the show Jericho a few years ago. I don't know if you guys watched it. It was like a post-apocalyptic nuclear TV show. Anyway, it was really – I enjoyed it. It was great fun. And they canceled it at the end of the first season. And via the internet, we were able to get it uncanceled. It was only the second time in the history of CBS a show had been uncanceled.
And uncanceled.
And this was like 5 years ago. So now the internet with Kickstarter didn't even exist back then. Mm. Imagine all the projects that could potentially –
Yeah, you know, and I don't really think it's just the internet. I think it's just how much of a strong fan base you have. And I'll give you an example for those of us that are that old, which makes me a party of one. Star Trek. Everybody knows, loves Star Trek. Well, Star Trek only had 2 seasons. They canceled it.
Yep.
They said, dude, you're out of here. There's no interest in this thing. They canceled it after 2 seasons in the 60s. And because there was such a huge fan base and the reruns of it, and there was no computers back then or internet.
Right.
It became its own entity. The Star Trek movies just go on in infinity, and all these different television shows that spawned from it.
Yeah, because think about this. There were 6 movies with the original cast, Star Trek 1 through Star Trek 6, and they didn't start filming those for, what, 10 years after the show was canceled. Imagine if Kickstarter and the internet had existed in 1970.
Oh, boy.
We'd have like 47 movies with the original cast.
Oh, yeah.
It's true.
That was like, back, you know, when people took pen to paper and wrote letters, you know.
Yep, yep. Star Trek 47. Captain Kirk finds his hernia brace.
Yeah, and Captain Kirk's still alive. That is another thing.
Isn't that amazing? He's like 80-something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. William Shatner's like 80-something. You see him in all these commercials, and he's still out there. You know, just
seems still no older it. Than a spry 65.
Yeah.
Yeah, you gotta love the original Star Trek, the stage settings and stuff like that, you know.
It is. It's held up over the years. You know, at the time it was cutting edge, but it's still fun to watch.
It is. And speaking of things that have, you know, lasted the test of time, there's a couple of guys out there in Massachusetts that have a great show. Now, Chrissy, I know you're from the Eastern Seaboard there, and you got to know Click and Clack.
Oh, I know Click and Clack. I love these guys. I'm so upset about this story.
Yeah, you hear them every Saturday when you're driving your car, if you're listening to NPR, yeah.
Well, they've been around for a long time, haven't they?
Yep.
I remember them when I was in high school, long time ago.
It's so cool. Sorry. Yeah,
me and Click and Clack, we were in a shop together.
Yeah.
That's before you needed a driver's license. We were working on the horse and buggy. Hence the Click and Clack.
Yes. Your license plate was 0002.
Yeah. Right.
So yeah, the long-running auto advice show is retiring this fall. The show, which has aired on NPR member stations for over 25 years, will continue to archive recordings from the 1,200 past episodes and occasional updates from the brothers. They have taped Car Talk at WBUR in Boston for 35 years. WBUR is the people behind PRX.
So, yes.
Yeah, oh, wow.
When we upload our show to PRX, it's going straight to WBUR.
Right.
The brothers, I mean, they have such a great humor, and that's one reason why people love listening to this show. And so when they were talking about how the show is coming to an end, of course, they go into their usual repertoire and Ray's like, you know, my brother has been work adverse. Now apparently even the 1 hour a week is killing him. And then Tom came in with, it's brutal. But they are getting, it's brutal. Like, this show is brutal. Yeah, so
1 hour a week of recording. Whoa.
But the way they talk, have you ever listened to those guys?
I've heard them, you know, so many times.
Like, now apparently even 1 week is killing them. You know, like, they have this like crazy.
I'm telling you, it's brutal.
Good impersonation.
Yeah, Bostonian.
Oh my God, it's really a Boston accent.
Don't drive like my brother.
I thought they were faking it at first. I thought it was just like a character that, you know, that they were
that's really
acting
them.
Or something.
And you know really what's really kind of trippy is that they've had the same automotive mechanic shop. They still work there. They still have it.
Excellent.
Wow.
And when people call up, I think that's really cool about their show. And I know you guys have all heard it. They're hysterical, you know, when they're talking to people and they're cutting it up. But they have the answers.
They have the answer. Yeah. They're brilliant.
You know, I mean, you can call them up and say, you know what, mate?
People call in like, I have a 1989 Toyota Celica and it's making this rrr noise. And you just listen
to it. Oh, yeah, it's just so annoying.
Right? Yeah, and then the guy goes, wow, is it making a rrr 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 noise or is it a rrr rrr rrr?
Oh, Well, then you got to do this.
Well, that's definitely the cell one. And the other guy will go like, now my brother's right.
Sounds like a carburetor. You know? Yeah.
I want to drive my car across the country just to
have get a look it. At it.
Yeah.
Have a look at the car.
It'll probably do more damage, but hey.
And another thing they do on their show, which is great, is I love the puzzler they always do.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard. I have never
figured one out.
Yeah, but they are getting older, so I'm sure they're going to enjoy their retirement. Ray's 63, Tom is 74. But even so, they're still going to do a twice weekly Dear Tom and Ray column and maintain a presence on Facebook. But going back to their humor, the vice president of programming at NPR said that their body of work ranks up there with the Marx Brothers, Mark Twain, and Mr. Goodwrench, of course. So, yeah, they will be missed. But it sounds like there's going to be, you know, plenty of backlog episodes. So you can always go back and, you know, start from the beginning, and you can hear from them on their blog and talk to them on Facebook. So they're not going away.
Okay.
Nice.
But I'll miss listening to them.
You know, sometimes there's just some things that you just wish you knew, and you're like, how can I find that out?
Well, I know someone who knows.
And I'm Jerry Renfro, and I'm in the know. You may not know this, but amazingly, not every person on Earth agrees with everything I say. It's true. I'm sure that if they took some time to think about it, they would agree with me on everything. But since that isn't the case, I found myself debating with people on a variety of subjects. So now on those very rare occasions when I am proven wrong, I'm more than willing to change my stance on a given subject if the person can, you know, argue their position well. Unfortunately, not everyone is willing to argue based only on the facts or merits of a case. More often than not, people resort to trying to bolster their position by falling into what are known as linguistic fallacies.
What is that, Jerry?
Linguistic fallacies are errors in thinking and speech.
Yeah,
so,
see, I thought that might have been something like with a recipe, you know, linguistic. You know?
Oh, no, that would be linguisa, but it's close. So some of them are obvious, but others are much more subtle and sneaky. So, for example, there is a fallacy called the fallacy of emotive language. So if you and I were to argue about something and I called you a communist, do you think that I'm trying to imply that you believe in the workers controlling the means of production or class against class? No, because calling someone a name like a communist is a way of using an emotionally charged word to label them in a way that makes their argument invalid. So essentially I'm saying, well, you can't be right because you're a commie. Another fallacy that people use is the fallacy of vicious abstraction. And this is where a statement is taken out of context or parts of it are left out to change the meaning. Have you ever heard the quote from the Bible, St. Paul, money is the root of all evil?
I have.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Definitely.
Well, that's interesting because that's not actually the quote. The love of money is the root of all evil. See, leaving out those two words completely changes the meaning of what he said. Another common one is Soren Kierkegaard, the philosopher. He said, if you marry, you will regret it. Now, if you listen to that, it sounds like, wow, what a curmudgeon. But the whole statement that he said is if you marry. He was totally a curmudgeon. His entire life, he never went more than 10 miles away from the city.
How long have you been waiting to work that into a conversation?
I use it every day whenever possible. You know, I like to eat.
Well, that's because you're a communist.
his cat is named curmudgeon.
Curmudgeon. Oh. No, I have a dog and he's not named curmudgeon. But anyway, he said if you marry, you will regret it. But the rest of the statement, he always says if you don't marry, you will regret it. He was trying to point out that no matter what choice you make in life, you inevitably end up regretting the path not taken. So, but again, the vicious abstraction, you take something out of context and you see it all the time in the news and interviews. People do that a lot. And then this brings us to the argumentum ad populum, which is Latin, which is appeal to the masses. So everybody believes it to be true, so it must be true, right? Let me tell you though, at one time, everybody knew the earth was flat. Everybody knew that the sun revolved around the earth. So just because everybody knows it doesn't make it the truth. Have you ever heard of an ad hominem attack? Sometimes people use that. An ad hominem attack is attacking the person who's saying it. So rather than debating your position, I say, well, you can't be right because you're a big old stinky head. See, it doesn't really bolster your argument.
Does that go along with being a communist?
Exactly. It's very similar. A lot of these are very similar, which exactly brings us to the last two, which are very similar. And those are the post hoc and non sequitur fallacies. Post hoc is Latin for post hoc ergo propter hoc, which means after this and because of this. So every time I blow my nose, my car breaks down. Does that make any sense?
No, because
they're not related. It's not causality. The other one is non sequitur, which you may have heard too. Non sequitur is two completely unlinked things being linked. So because the sky is blue, people shouldn't drive faster than 55 miles an hour. Again, not linked. One has nothing to do with the other. Yet people work these into arguments all the time. So the next time you find yourself defending a position or trying to point out to someone the error of their ways, try to avoid falling into the traps of these linguistic fallacies.
Okay, I will do that.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I'll call them. I'll say fallacy.
And now you know.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Blackstone's special feature.
Blank images float across my screen. Tell me, is this what life really means? It's all I can do. I'm daydreaming of you. Nothing is better than the love we make, like a warm summer breeze across my face. When I'm with you, the world goes away. Longing to be where you are.
Clay's Sim talks about collaborating on the song 40,000 Feet in this interview with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
All right, welcome everybody to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today we're very privileged to have on Clay Sims from Denmark, and he is here to talk about his new song, 40,000 Feet, and about his return to the U.S. where he's going to go to Nashville, the music capital of the USA. Hey, Clay, how you doing?
I'm great, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, how's it going out there in Denmark? You're in Copenhagen, right?
Yeah, I'm back home in Copenhagen for now, and it has been a great summer, but now the fall is kicking in, and, you know, it's 8 o'clock here now and in the evening, and it's totally dark already. So I'm getting ready for the winter.
Yeah, and so, what kind of weather do you have out there? What's temperature-wise?
Oh, I actually don't remember in Fahrenheit, but it has been like around 14 degrees Celsius for the last few days.
Oh, okay.
So it's getting colder, you know. You definitely want to wear a jacket and a scarf or something when you head outside.
Okay. Well, we're here in Ashland, Oregon, which is in the Pacific Northwest, and we're having like an incredibly hot summer. It's already the middle of September, and we're still, you know, in the high 90s every day, so kind of envy you that, yeah?
I wish I was there. It's a little too cold for me here now, you know. The good thing about this winter time is that it usually, you know, like, brings up the songwriter in me, you know, like, sitting at home with the guitar and light some candles and write some songs. So
yeah? What have you been writing lately?
I've just been writing a few new tunes, some with some fellow Danes here and some by myself, and then I'm co-writing Transatlantic using Skype, as we are doing right now with the people in America. So
yeah, isn't that fantastic? I mean, it's just opened up a whole new world to everyone.
Sure, and the way you can keep in contact with everybody, you know, and it feels like you're in the room together, you know, sit here with your laptop and, you know, you have visual as well and sit and write songs together. It actually works really well. And then what I really like about it compared to like a more traditional writing session is that then you can work for half an hour together and then you can both hang up and say, let's work separate for a little while and then call each other in a few hours.
You know, I didn't even think about that, but that makes total sense. You could you're sitting down and you can see each other and you write and you hear each other and then you say, you know what, let me walk away from this for a little bit. And then when you come back, you're both have fresh ideas.
Exactly. And you know, a lot of people, they tend to write a little better when they are in solitary, you know. Mm-hmm. And I have a little of that as well, especially with the chords and the music. So it really helps if there's some part, you know, a chorus or a bridge or something missing, you know. We usually come up with it when we hang up, then we sit for an hour or so and then call each other back up and then we have gone even further, you know. So I really like that.
When you wrote 40,000 Feet, which is a fantastic song and it really kind of burning up the charts there, you wrote that solo, right?
No, that is
with
my great friend and co-writer, Jeff Pollock. He lives in Northern California. And the story about that song is we were both flying in from, I was flying in from Nashville, Tennessee. He was flying in from San Francisco. We were both going to Utah to the Sundance Film Festival.
Oh, okay.
And I had written the music 2 days earlier, and we met up there in Utah, and in the car driving up north to the festival, I was telling him about this new song, and I played him, you know, the little draft on my iPhone in his car stereo, and he said, "Oh, that's incredible! I just wrote these new words called about, you know, like flying, and then when you are away from the people you love, then you see who they really are, you know." And they just fit together so well, and it sounded like it was written by the same person on the same day. And of course, we had to do some tweaks and, you know, finish the song later on. You know, we did that over that week, you know, tweak the lyrics. But it was more or less finished right away, I would say 90%.
It just all kind of came together. You know, it's a great song. And why don't we hear a little bit of it right now? It's still not Wow, that was great. It's hard to believe that it came together like almost all in one sitting, as it were.
It was totally, you know, like I was, it was just like, and the way he has built the lines, we only had to change so little in the lyrics to make it fit the song, you know. And it was, the whole story behind the song is that I was, I have written a lot of slow, low-key songs, you know, more mellow songs in my life. And I was just like in a more happy mode. In that time and during that time, and then I was just like, no, I want to start writing some more upbeat. So that's something I've kind of taught myself. It's newer to me than writing slow songs, that's for sure.
Right. And what do you like better, writing or performing, or are they kind of intertwined?
Oh no, my live concerts, performing is just the way I live. That's where I get, you know, you get an instant feedback from who's ever in the audience, you know, and I really live that. I love it. And most of the reason for me I started writing my own songs was that I found it really hard to play other people's songs when I was younger.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I've actually found it easier to write my own stuff because there was not a curriculum or way it should be. So it was really good. And then go and perform them live is where you get the as I said, the feedback, and where you kind of instantly know if you've written something that works or not.
Yeah, you know, I would imagine if I would, you know, not being a musician, I would kind of equate it to, you know, say like athletics. I would imagine it'd be a lot more fun to actually be playing in the game as opposed to being a spectator.
I don't know. I enjoy going to concerts a lot. And I get a lot of new ideas when I'm at concerts and with other artists and other people. And I prefer performing, because that's what I do, but I really love just to be involved in the music scene and, you know, meet with other writers and hear what they have written. And, you know, there are a lot of fantastic artists and writers out there, and it's a privilege just to be allowed to be a part of it, you know.
Now, when you go to other concerts, who do you see? Do you see the local acts, or do you go to concerts here in America?
I've done both, and, you know, I like all genres, really. You know, I mostly listen to classical music when I'm at home, or, you know, sometimes, mostly when I'm in the States, I listen to radio, not so much here in Denmark. I mostly listen to what I have on iTunes or stuff like that. There are always, you know, there are a few artists that have, you know, every time they release something, I'll go and listen to it, and that, you know, includes all the old guys, Peter Gabriel, Sting, Neil Young, Peter Gabriel, I already mentioned him, mm-hmm. Paul Simon and stuff. And then there are the newer artists like John Mayer, and where I, every time they release something, I have to go and listen to it over and over again and figure out what they have written. When some artist or bands, or they become big enough, like massive, then, you know, so enough people will listen to them that, you know, that they can go wherever they want, basically.
Right. I think Peter Gabriel and Sting would be in there in that category.
Yeah, for sure. Sting is having a lot of, and Peter Gabriel as well, in Germany and Spain and Italy, I know. But they, you know, I think it's the whole world. But I know for a fact that Peter Gabriel has a massive following in Germany.
Oh, so great. Cleese, it's been great talking with you, and I really look forward to seeing you and hearing your new music. You can get Cleese's 40,000 Feet and other recordings at cleesesims.com. That's www.cleesecem.com. And all the links are cool. And all the other, you can also get all the links to his Facebook and Amazon and everything on justimagineinc.com. And it's been just a real pleasure. And we look forward to speaking with you again.
Oh, thanks a lot for taking the time. And for sure, I'll see you in the US, and we'll play some songs.
To learn more about Clay's Sim, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
Sergio Magaña visited us right before the dawn of the sixth sun. He's back to meet with students in his Obsidian Mirror workshop, and he caught up with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of Get Behind Me, Not Stay There. Today we have on Sergio Magaña. Sergio, so good to see you again. We saw you last year.
Yeah.
When you were here.
It looked like yesterday.
It does look like, well, you look like yesterday. I look like they aged a few years. I must be having bad dreams, you know?
You probably,
think
yeah.
That's probably what it is.
Yeah.
Well,
no, but you don't look as a bad dream. Don't worry.
Well, I understand. You have a. You're here in Ashland. We're in Ashland, Oregon, right now, and yeah. You are going to be doing a workshop on the Obsidian Mirror.
Obsidian Mirror, yeah.
Obsidian Mirror, and for all of our listeners out there and our viewing audience, talk a little about the Obsidian Mirror. And, you know what it means, and you know.
Yeah. Obsidian. It's like a volcanic rock that is. It's black. For the ancient tradition of Mexico. The first energy, in order to create, had to reflect herself or himself. So to create like a subject and an object. And for the tradition, all this creation, you, me, mm-hmm. are in the mirror. So it's the place where everything is like kind of reflecting. So they call it Tezcatlipoca, that means a smoking mirror, because we are all, for the tradition, in the mirror, but we are so fascinated by, like, hypnotized by the reflection mm-hmm. that we have believed that we are this one, and we have forgot the one that reflects. So for the tradition, it's like the most sacred object. To stop not just being the reflection, and to begin being again the one that reflects and the reflection.
Okay, so if I'm following you, it's like you look in the Obsidian Mirror, or like with all people, this is just like, I'm from a layman's point of view. I'm thinking, okay, so when I look in the mirror, I'm believing the reflection.
Yeah.
Instead of like, you know, who I really am.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I am this person, but when I look in that mirror, you know, the mirror tells me, okay, you're this person.
But if you think no one knows who really is, what you know about you at least your face and other things, you only know your reflection.
Exactly. It's like the, you know, like if you look in a well, you know, and you see your reflection, what you see is only on the surface.
Yeah, and it's quite deep because even we only know our reflection. And our reflection, for example, your right hand is your left. So it's in reverse.
Right.
So that makes like for the tradition, they believe that this reality is quite tricky.
Oh, okay.
So, and for us, it's so important because we say, where we created, because all what we think it's our reality is only is that reflection. So we say, where you created is where you can destroy it in the mirror. So the exercises that we do in the mirror are very deep. You enter very deep in through breathing in an altered state of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that you learn in the mirror is with the open eyes, of course, is to disappear your reflection.
Oh, I see.
And to see only the darkness of the mirror. That for us is like the essence, the primary essence of the individual beings. So it's to see who you really are. And then you begin like changing the reflection and doing wonderful things. Even to find who you are in the dreams, the animal and all those things. Sometimes you are in the mirror and your face disappears and it transforms into an animal.
Now that is fascinating because... you know, I like the idea of like, you know, you're looking in the mirror and you take away the reflection, you know, or the facade that we all, you know, put on for the outside world, for lack of a better word. And then and then you start seeing like your inner self, right? And then now this is where listen, folks, this is where I was like, you know, the animal part about it, you know, I don't get it. So I mean, I think it's really, you know, fascinating. But were you saying like when you see your true self, like there's like an animal that you were that you
not always the true self is nothing.
Oh, okay.
So that's the first.
Well, I've got that covered.
Yeah. Okay. that's the first exercise in the mirror is to learn to disappear your face and to see nothing. And it's quite deep because a lot of people, for example, with disappearing your face and the reflection, you can disappear the idea of who you think you are. If you think that you are sick, if you think that you have this problem or that history, you can disappear it in the mirror. And a lot of people have healed themselves just disappearing in the mirror and going to the primary essence. But then, for us, what we call the Nahual, that is a word that Carlos Castaneda made very popular. Mm-hmm. Nahual comes from the Nahuatl, that it was the ancient language of the Aztecs and Toltecs. The Nehua, that means I, who really I am. So if you, we can say that the real truth is that we are. That energy that is nothing, the darkness in the mirror.
Right.
But in a second level, we can begin seeing like an energy that is like a kind of hologram of yourself, that hologram transforms and changes. And sometimes it changes into an animal.
And has this happened to you?
Yeah, of course.
And what animal are you?
Okay. No, because for example, for us in a while,
I mean, does it change? Like you know,
you can use the.
Does it change? Is it always the same animal, or is it?
Okay, for example, by calendar, mm-hmm. because in the Aztec calendar, in the study that we call Tonalama, you have like a favorite animal that your Nahual takes. That, for example, for me, it's a spider. But in the mirror, for example, I have a Nahuatl name. I am Sergio in Christian. Is my Christian name, but mm-hmm. my Nahuatl name is Ocelocoyotl, that means coyote jaguar. I got that name from the mirror because I was watching my image and I said where or the energy how should I be named, and it's very interesting because from the eyes turn like kind of red, mm-hmm. and then it makes this shape of the animal, so it make a clear coyote. And then I said, okay, that's the only one, or I should take two. And then it appeared a jaguar. So, and those are, it's very interesting because those are the Nahuales of Tezcatlipoca, of the ruler of the mirror.
Oh, okay.
So I chose both.
So you chose wisely.
Yeah. For going to the mirror and to the dreaming state, yeah. But it's very impressive to see it.
I haven't seen it. I would love to do this one time and see, you know, what happens. But you know, speaking of your workshops, I know you're here in Ashland. You're doing a workshop here in Ashland.
Yeah.
And you were recently in Italy, right?
Yeah, I was in Italy. Yeah.
And well, we want to say hello to everyone in Italy. Big audience out there.
ciao tutti italiani, amici.
The you are like going like all around the world, so this is pretty fascinating. You know that this is not just a thing that came out of Mexico City or something that's going on in the Southwest United States. It's going all over the world. You know, for everybody out there watching and listening, I am just like totally blown away by this dream concept. You know, of a you know, one, I don't know exactly how you do it or what the benefits are, but it just seems to me just like, you know, just to know. How to, you know, dream better would just be like a benefit for everyone.
Oh, that's a fascinating thing. For example, there was an Aztec phrase that said, the one that doesn't remember his dreams is like a living death because don't have any control of his awake. For the tradition, your Nahual, the one that you are sleeping, has four times the power of the tonal of the awake. So from the people of the warriors and the people in the power, they were like trained to remember and to control their dreams since they were very, very, very young.
Do you get to practice any of your dream technologies on the planes?
Yeah, I in every land.
Oh, yeah. Wow, you know, that's quite a schedule.
Yeah, it's getting...
Do you find when you're in all these different countries that when you sit down with the new people, new cultures, new languages, it's all become like really exciting and fresh?
Yeah, easier because...
Well, sure, at some point it has to become like work.
No, yeah, it's work, but you find friends at the first time, it's like everything new. Now you come, I see you, for example, and all right. The things, the people that you know. But for me, what is exciting is to see how the different cultures, for example, the Italians dream similar to the Italians, the Americans to the Americans, how this geographical situation influence how you dream, the perception, all those things. That's
there a
fascinating.
Big difference, say between America and Italy? Is there a big difference in the dreams?
In the dreams, for example, yeah, it's like that. For example, the kind of dreams of Italians are much more dramatic. They say and appear blood and all these kind of things, like wow. The culture. So for me, that kind of research, personal uh-huh. research, of when the people begin asking about their dreams and seeing how are also influenced by, I don't know if the land or the culture, it's so interesting.
Sergio, it's been great having you on again. And we really look forward to, you know, seeing you next time around again as well.
Thank you very much.
And we want to tell everybody, you know, be sure to check out our workshop when it comes to your area if you happen to be in Toronto, Canada. All right. Well, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you. All right. You, Charlie.
Bye-bye now.
To learn more about Sergio Magaña, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
And look in my direction, I caught it in my hands today. I finally made a tricky French connection. You winked and gave me your okay.
In 1982, Sue Grafton introduced us to Kinsey Millhone. 30 years later, Kinsey is an established international icon. Sue, a number one best-selling author. To mark this anniversary year, Sue has given us stories that reveal Kinsey's origins and Sue's past in her new book, Kinsey and Me.
The Parker Shotgun. The Christmas holidays had come and gone, and the new year was underway. January, in California, is as good as it gets. Cool, clear, and green, with a sky the color of wisteria and a surf that thunders like a volley of gunfire in a distant field. My name is Kinsey Millhone. I'm a private investigator, licensed, bonded, insured, white, female, age 32, unmarried, and physically fit. That Monday morning, I was sitting in my office with my feet up, wondering what life would bring, when a woman walked in and tossed a photograph on my desk. My introduction to the Parker Shotgun began with a graphic view of its apparent effect when fired at a formerly nice-looking man at close range. His face was still largely intact, but he had no use now for a pocket comb. With effort, I kept my expression neutral as I glanced up at her. "Somebody killed my husband." "I can see that," I said. She snatched the picture back and stared at it as though she might have missed some telling detail. Her face suffused with pink, and she blinked back tears. "Jesus, Rudd was killed 5 months ago, and the cops have done... I'm so sick of getting the runaround I could scream." She sat down abruptly and pressed a hand to her mouth, trying to compose herself. She was in her late 20s with a gaudy prettiness. Her hair was an odd shade of brown, like cherry coke, worn shoulder length and straight. Her eyes were large, a lush mink brown. Her mouth was full. Her complexion was all warm tones, tanned and clear. She didn't seem to be wearing makeup, but she was still as vivid as a magazine illustration, a good four-color run on slick paper. She was 7 months pregnant by the look of her, not voluminous yet, but rotund. When she was calmer, she identified herself as Lisa Osterling. "That's a crime lab photo. How'd you come by it?" I said when the preliminaries were disposed of. She fumbled in her handbag for a tissue and blew her nose. "I have my little ways."
Provides moving and surprising insights into the woman behind the bestsellers. Fans will admire Grafton's impressive output and feisty fictional detective all the more, knowing the challenging beginnings from which they both grew, says Publishers Weekly. Sue Grafton is a New York Times bestselling author published in 28 countries and 26 languages. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com.
Behind Me Now, Stay There is a Just Imagine It, Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio, Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Chrissy McIntyre.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook. And remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.
Get out of there.